You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, Earth people, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, my guest is Nick Redfern. Originally from England, Nick lives in Arlington, Texas. He is a full-time author and journalist specializing in a wide range of unsolved mysteries, including UFOs, alien contact, Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, government conspiracies, and paranormal phenomena. He writes regularly for UFO Magazine, 40 and Times, Paranormal Magazine, and Fate. His previous books include Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, Strange Secrets, A Covert Agenda, and There's Something in the Woods. Among his many exploits, Redfern has investigated reports of aliens in Mexico, lake monsters in Scotland, vampires in Puerto Rico, werewolves in England, and crashed UFOs in the United States. We'll be discussing all of those things and his new book, which is now out, Contactees, A History of Alien-Human Interaction, which is available at Amazon.com. So let's welcome Nick to the show now. Hi, Nick. How are you?
Hey, Lance. I'm doing good. Thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You know, I really thoroughly enjoyed your book.
Oh, thanks.
You know, what did I was born in 1950,
mm-hmm.
and my parents were kind of a little bit on the bohemian, slightly avant-garde side. And I vaguely remember as a child that they used to talk about some of these people that you mentioned in the beginning of the book.
Mm.
And, you know, I was totally ignorant of the very beginnings of the whole UFO movement and how famous some of these people became. Mm. It's really a fascinating story, and it filled in a lot of blanks for me. And then I really enjoyed the fact that you moved on into various kinds of other forms of encounter, which we can get into too. So it was quite a wonderful read, and it's entertaining and some moments of humor and well written.
Oh, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. So how did you begin to, you've done a lot of research, how did you begin to start out?
You mean with the book?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, basically what it was, you know, I do a lot of conferences and lectures, and often, you know, in question and answer sessions, you know, the subject just gets into various areas of the whole UFO subject.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I found over the last couple of years particularly is that where you have a lot of people who are perhaps newer to the subject, you know, they're fully aware of things like Area 51 and alien abductions, but mm-hmm. through no fault of their own, you know, the early years of the whole UFO subject and the UFO movement, really, to a lot of people new to the subject, aren't that well known. And one of the reasons is because a lot of the early books and magazines on the subject, you know, they're just so hard to come by today.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Or they're very expensive in some cases.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, unless you sort of, you know, you're prepared to spend $50 here and $60 there on somebody's book, you know, it can be difficult. So I thought, one of the reasons I thought was, well, why not go back and address these early cases of contact, alien contact again?
Yeah.
Present it for a new audience, but don't just sort of go back and just retell the stories. Try and dig into the evidence and try and come to some conclusions as to what, you know, what was going on.
Uh-huh.
And so that was basically the idea behind it, was to, you know, just, I guess, retrospectively look back at the contactees and see what we could learn from the cases and try and put new slants on it and find new evidence.
Well, they were just fascinating stories, and, you know, some of them were just riveting, especially the man in the tavern that had the fizzy drink.
Orfeo Angelucci.
Yes, oh my goodness. And then the other one that met the woman who was very seductive. What's one of your favorite stories of these people that...
Well, I mean, it's difficult to kind of pinpoint it to one, I suppose. I mean, one of the things I've found is that, you know, the contactees were sort of definitive characters. You know, they were all sort of memorable people. They would kind of stand out in a crowd anyway.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, Orfeo Angelucci, Truman Bethlehem, some of their stories, because they're so controversial and memorable, but equally, you know, you think, well, you know, could there actually be a grain of truth there as well, you know, or several grains of truth?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it's, in terms of what you can learn from the subjects, arguably the whole movement is as entertaining as it is intriguing and informative, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what I find funny is that it seems that there's so many different UFO communities out there, and they've all got their own slant, and they don't seem to allow too much open-mindedness to the other aspects, and that puzzles me, because this is a whole area of investigation that really kind of requires an open mind.
Yeah, I mean, you do unfortunately find that, not just in the UFO subject, but in all areas of investigating the unexplained. You know, it's like with UFOs, that you have the people who think UFOs are alien, then you have people who take more like an esoteric view that it's some sort of interdimensional thing. Other people, you know, look at other ideas and scenarios, and you often find that it creates, I suppose, factions where, you know, he's the person who believes that, she's the person who believes this, and, you know, sometimes they don't mix, you know, with each other's camps, etc.
Yeah.
And it does, because instead of having an open mind, I don't think it's done deliberately, but sometimes you do find that people follow one belief system and stick to that belief system, even, you know, in evidence, when there's evidence suggesting that we should be looking into other areas as well. It does become sort of very sort of polarized into different areas.
Yeah, and, you know, you make such an interesting point towards the end that we might need to completely rethink what is behind these people who are visiting. For instance, in the beginning, I guess, visitors used to just get out of the saucers and start talking to people, and in some cases there would be, like, two lights that would come close to the car, and then a televisor screen with a beautiful man and a woman speaking to them. And I mean, this is just such fantastic stuff. I just love it. You know, you suggest that maybe there's something we're not really seeing what's behind the curtain.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you look at the contactees, so people who aren't necessarily familiar with the contactee movement, I'm sure everybody today has heard of the so-called alien abductees, where people report being taken on spacecraft and subjected to, like, distressing medical experimentation by these little small aliens that have become known as the Greys.
Well, yeah, Whitley Strieber is one of the biggest opponents of that.
Yeah, they were sort of 3 to 4 foot tall, large heads, black eyes, etc. Now, you know, everybody, even little kids, can recognize that sort of image of what an alien's supposed to look like. But if you go back to the early 50s, late 40s, nobody was talking about abductees. It was all contactees. And the big difference between today's abductees and the contactees of 40, 50, 60 years ago is that they were claiming that primarily the situation was usually the same. They would feel compelled. Certain people who had no actual prior interest in UFOs would suddenly feel compelled to sort of jump in their cars and drive out to a remote location, not even really knowing why. And then suddenly this, you know, classic flying saucer would loom into view, would land, and very human-looking aliens would allegedly come off the craft with heads of long blonde hair and dressed in silver suits, and they would start talking about how we should disarm our nuclear weapons and everybody should live in peace and harmony. And it was almost, you know, as I describe in the book, like a cosmic hippie-type experience. And one of the things, you know, that's, because the stories were so controversial, one of the things that happened was that it sort of polarized people in ufology at the time into two camps. There were those who interpreted the stories literally, that these contactees actually met long-haired aliens from this planet or that star system or wherever. Or, on the other hand, you had people who were saying, no, this is absolute nonsense, these people are just liars and fantasists. But, you know, as I point out in the book, I think there's some strong evidence that there was a genuine alien intelligence at work, alien being, you know, definitively non-human. where I think there's a good possibility that the contactees were almost rendered into like an altered state where their minds were played with, and some sort of alien phenomenon may have manifested in, you know, in a way that looked to them like long-haired, human-looking aliens.
Right.
But it may have been almost like a Matrix-style hologram, or, you know, a very extensive, you know, mind manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
And what was actually going on isn't what they were literally seeing, but it was manifesting in a way that was sort of understandable for the people. You know, if you imagine there's a really sort of highly advanced alien intelligence millions of years in front of us, trying to contact and speak with us would be like us trying to talk to an ant. But if you can kind of present yourself in a fashion and an appearance, even if it's a mirage or a hallucination, or the mind's played with, they can still get that message across, and we understand it. So I think that was going on to a large extent, that people's minds were being played with, but there was something trying to interact and speak with them.
Well, you know, I had Jim Sparks on the show once, and he is a lifelong abductee. Mm. And so whatever his experiences that he had, he was fighting them and resisting them.
Mm-hmm.
And this went on for years and years, and he had total recall, almost total recall, mm-hmm. of all of the experiences. And it ended up that they were all in front of visor screens or telescreens, mm-hmm. and being shown, you know, the Earth in its pristine form and what the Earth looked like now and where it was mm-hmm. headed. And so it does seem that there's some kind of ecological message that they're trying to get across, mm-hmm. in addition to having our children. You know, I've talked to other people who have been on ships and seen, you know, rows and rows of babies in these mm-hmm. kind of enclosed clear glass kind of pods. I wouldn't call them pod people. They were babies.
Mm-hmm.
But what was so remarkable for her, she was being shown, you know, what they were doing with her fluids,
mm-hmm.
Was that they weren't crying and they weren't making any noise and they weren't smiling or laughing or anything. They were just mm-hmm. still. And it was kind of a, she remembers that was kind of a spooky moment.
Mm.
You know, to think that maybe there are Earth alien children being, you know, hatched all over the place. And it's also quite possible that some forms of ancient civilizations are here underground as well, that were here before us.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of theories like that.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that these things, these beings aren't coming from point A to point B every day, that actually have, you know, bases or some sort of installations on the Earth itself, which would actually make more sense, you know, given a large number of sightings. It would make more sense if they have sort of like a staging post here rather than having to keep coming back and forth, etc.
Absolutely. Well, I was quite shocked. You know, I've always been looking out at, you know, pictures of fuzzy objects that are supposed to be, you know, oh, we caught a UFO and blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, I stumbled across one site after another that was in a program on, I think it was the History Channel, that showed ships going into the water.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole movement of that. I had never even I'd never even thought of that there might be underground bases that they just zipped underneath the water, and that would be a very easy thing to do. So, you know, that's quite possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at the Earth. I mean, there's parts of the Earth in the oceans where it's really deep that even our best submarines just cannot reach even now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they would be the ideal places to hide out. And, you know, we're looking, scanning the skies with radar, et cetera, and they're sort of doing their thing below us.
Yes, absolutely. Now, we can't have a show without talking about this part of it. So many people believe or are curious about the theoretical contracts that the certain groups made with various governments, our own included. And I believe it was during Eisenhower's watch that he actually went to a meeting and agreed to allow certain elements that were extraterrestrial to work within our government and had given them permission.
Mm-hmm.
And those that had to do with that was supposedly the beginning of the abduction scenario.
Mm-hmm.
What about the idea that the government is extremely involved with this and mm-hmm. that they may even be possible for many of the abductions that create negative experiences?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there's lots of stories and rumors about, you know, treaties and pacts, et cetera. And I don't doubt for one minute that government agencies around the world, you know, major governments at least, know far more than they're telling us. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
The big problem I have with that story about Eisenhower is not the idea that Eisenhower, as president, wouldn't have been briefed on the UFO subject and the deeper secrets. I think he would. But it's like, why would aliens that are all-powerful even need to enter into an agreement anyway? Mm. You know, why would they need to get permission to do abductions when they obviously have the technology just to go ahead and do it anyway?
Mm.
You know, it's kind of like, if they're all-powerful, even if we'd have said no, they could have just said, well, so what? We're going to do it anyway.
Well, that's true.
So, but I don't doubt, you know, at all that there has, well, we know there's been official interest in people in the UFO subject. The contactees, for example, you know, I got countless FBI files that have now been declassified under the Freedom of Information Act, how most of the major contactees of the 50s were being closely watched by the FBI, who were deeply interested in their stories and, you know, would question them, saying, you know, why are you writing this book? What do the aliens want? That sort of thing. So, I think in that respect, you know, there's far more known at an official level than meets the eye. But, yeah, I mean, abductions, you know, arguably that's one of the bigger reasons why I think there's so much secrecy surrounding the subject, because if people are literally being, you know, taken from their homes, kidnapped and subjected to medical experimentation, and the government really isn't in a meaningful position to stop it,
right.
That never mind the fact that aliens exist, but the very fact that they're doing this is enough reason for there to be a huge amount of secrecy surrounding the subject anyway. You know, it's one thing, the fact that aliens might be visiting here itself might not be reasons enough to hide that fact.
Right.
But if, when, you know, if the president stood up tomorrow and said, okay, you know, aliens do exist, we've been hiding the truth for X number of years, but now we've decided to come clean.
Yeah.
The problem is, that would then open the floodgates to all these other questions that which might be quite unsettling, you know, if we got the answers. And I think the government realizes that, you know, they can't tell part of the story. If they open the floodgates, then literally the floodgates are wide open. And I think, you know, there are certain parts they probably wouldn't mind releasing. But on the other hand, they know that if they do that, then, you know, there's no way stopping everything else coming out. So.
Well, I agree with you, and I empathize for the government's position. But I also feel that we as human beings, and possibly extraterrestrial ourselves, have a right to know this stuff. And the fact that they've kept it secret for so long does create a difficulty, but...
Yeah.
I think that human beings will be more mature and handle this much better than anybody could possibly realize. I think we need to be given a chance.
Yeah. No, sorry, go on.
Yeah, and also the disclosures could be done in such a way where there is no legal repercussion for those who are disclosing what happened. It's simply, this is what happened. You're going to have to forgive us for having kept this secret. We can't prosecute. Let's move on from here.
No, I think that would be a very good approach. I think one of the reasons also that prevents that taking place is that although I don't doubt that, you know, government agencies have massive amounts of more material than, you know, we can even begin to comprehend probably,
right.
But they might not actually have the answers as to what's going on and why these things are actually coming here. You know, it's kind of like, say, for example, that, you know, if you take Roswell, if the government got its hands on a crashed UFO and a number of alien bodies, well, all that really tells the government is that aliens exist, they've come here and they've crashed. It doesn't actually provide any answers as to why they're coming here and what their agenda is. And maybe the government has a lot of evidence, you know, radar reports, photographs, bodies, craft even, but they might not actually have the answer as to why they're coming here. Mm. And I think so part of it could be, part of the secrecy could be, ironically, the lack, not the lack of evidence, but the lack of an answer as to what's going on.
Huh.
You know,
well, that's an interesting way to
look
at it.
I mean, it's kind of ironic. It's kind of like if somebody time-traveled one of today's cars or a truck through time to 200 years ago, you know, and the people would see it.
Yeah.
They would probably understand what it was. They wouldn't be able to replicate it. And if they had no contact with the people who built it, and they just hid it away, it's like, well, yeah, somebody's far more in advance of us, but we know nothing really about what they're doing. So.
Yeah, we'll just get the corporations to back engineer it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I've heard about the guy who was the top military brass up for the defense, of the United States, and he went to one of the corporations. I don't know names, and I wouldn't name them if I had to. And he was met by three lawyers, and he said, well, I'm here to find out about, you know, what you know about the, you know, what have you back engineered and what's going on. And the only answer he got was, you don't have a need to know.
Yeah.
And this was the top brass, you know, it was in charge of everything. So, you know, there's supposedly 47 levels of clearance above the president, so we can't assume that they know what's going on.
No,
it may be going on, but we don't know who is involved with it.
No, that's right. I mean, my personal view is that, you know, a lot of people think that governments, you know, the government is like one unified body.
Oh,
but
right,
in reality, you have different agencies, and, you know, people like the CIA, the FBI, the National Security Agency, they don't share information with each other.
Yeah.
You know, never mind with the press or the public.
Right.
So, in other words, I think the way the secret has been kept is that, you know, it's not like if you join the CIA, you're suddenly briefed on what happened at Roswell.
Absolutely.
You know, that's nonsense to think that would even happen. I think that what exists somewhere is that there's a very sort of deep cover organization buried very deeply somewhere within the government or the military or a combination or whatever, and they're the ones sitting on the hard evidence.
Yeah.
And they may not even be like an official organization that exists, you know, like the CIA. It may be, you know, kind of like a group of people who've agreed to keep the secret and who are in control of it.
Yeah.
I think, they're in control of the secret, but they're not an agency which we can pinpoint. It's just the money's being moved through, you know, black budget funding, etc.
Exactly.
Kept away from Congress, and that's how it's all hidden. So.
I'm pretty certain that that's the way it is.
Yeah.
Now, you know, one thing we do know is that the various alphabet soup agencies have done numerous experiments with LSD, blanket spraying of the population. They've done one-on-ones. They've done groups. A lot of mind control experiments. And you document some of that in your book, don't you?
Yeah, I do. There's actually a very weird story about one of the contactees, a man named Orfeo Angelucci, and he was one of the early 1950s contactees who'd had this experience driving home late at night, saw these strange lights in the sky that sort of transformed into, I guess, like very human-looking aliens, a man and a woman, and he claimed a number of interactions and meetings at a remote location with these beings over the course of several years.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a couple of books on the subject about his encounters. And not long after the first book was published, he was approached by this man who called himself Adam, who said he wanted to meet with Angelucci to discuss his encounters because this guy Adam had supposedly had a very similar experience.
Uh-huh.
And so they chose a particular location, a diner, an out-of-the-way remote diner. And Angelucci went along, sat there in the diner, the guy came in. And basically what happened, a very unusual scenario, this guy Adam said to Angelucci, well, you know, before we start, I want you to take this pill. You know, so he popped the pill in Angelucci's drink, which was like a Coke or something. You know, and he just swilled it down, which is probably isn't the best thing to do if a stranger gives you a pill and just says, take this. But he did. But what's interesting is this was roughly 1953, and Angelucci said that he took the pill, and they started talking about alien encounters. And within about 20 minutes or so, he started to feel strange, like kind of like spaced out, and he said that the diner where they were in, the colours in the room seemed to take on new life, and you know, everything seemed profound and strange and fantastic, and he started seeing all these weird images and colours floating around. It was almost like he'd been put on an LSD trip when you read his story. And he said that sat on the table opposite were two military guys who were staring very intently at them and following the entire conversation. And to me, it sounds like he was sort of put into a drug-induced state to possibly interrogate him about his UFO experiences, and the government wanted to know what was going on. And the way they did it was to sort of lull him into a, you know, a drug-fueled state where he'd be susceptible and he would spill his guts, basically, on everything that happened to him. And the interesting thing is, you know, I said this was sort of 1953. This was right around the time when the CIA particularly was doing its MK Ultra experiments, mind control, much of which was centered around the use of LSD for several reasons. One, to try and see if it would sort of destroy people's memories. You know, they could interrogate them and then they'd forget. And the other one was basically to get information out of them, you know, and the person wouldn't know. And when you read it in the historical context of what the CIA was doing, it sounds very much like that he was, you know, subjected or targeted by one of these agencies that was doing a lot of weird mind control research. And I think there's several indications that a number of UFO cases could be relevant to this whole phenomenon, that people were rendered into sort of altered states and thought they'd even seen UFOs when it may have been some sort of weird government project, you know, to try and determine to what extent the human mind could be altered and manipulated.
It was one of my favorite stories that you wrote about, and one of the things that stood out for me with Orfeo was that he describes in detail the quite a positive, uplifting feeling. I mean, it wasn't anything negative at all. It was just a what about there was ethereal music, and the person sitting across from him said, well, look in your glass or something, and he looks and there's a woman dancing in there making music in the glass.
Yeah, exactly, like a little woman. I mean, like I said in the book, this sounds like a classic hallucination, you know, a real sort of mind-bending trip he was on.
It was a good one, whatever it was.
It was a good one, whatever it was.
I wouldn't mind getting hold of some of that stuff.
No, I think I think he actually enjoyed it. He was positive for it, you know, he had a good time. But, you know, I think that's one of the important things, you know, to remember is that, retrospectively, it was like a classic LSD hallucinatory drug-type scenario. There's no doubt in my mind that that's what he was rendered into. The big question is why, but when you have these military people sitting in the room watching him as well, you've got to begin to wonder.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
But that shouldn't take, you know, I would stress, that shouldn't take away from the fact that there are genuine UFOs as well, but I think the government is also manipulating the subject for its own ends. So there's like, you know, the government staging stuff and faking things to confuse the fact that aliens really are coming here.
Yeah. Well, I've also had guests on the show, Andrew D. Bajago, who said that there's a base on Mars and a base on Moon, and that this group that you talked about that's very deep, that doesn't exist, has back-engineered some of the ships that go that can travel to those places using anti-grav and various other things. So, but we wouldn't have any way of knowing that, obviously, because it's such a deep cover and the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. So, I mean, we can only hope that someday the time will pass and we'll be allowed to play in the sandbox with, you know, these other people. But for now, it seems like they're pulling all the strings. But not all of the strings. You mentioned crop circles and orbs. And that's something I don't understand. I've had several guests on about that, and one of my close friends has taken some incredible orb pictures. I mean, they're just off the charts. And, I mean, I'm just amazed to see these things, and she says that she feels a presence and an energy, and they become her friends. So that's going on all over the place.
Oh, yeah. I mean, crop circles, you know, it's an intriguing phenomenon. You get a lot of sightings of the, you know, these small little balls of light flitting around the crop circles in England particularly. And they seem to be, you know, either under intelligent control or, as some people think, they could be some sort of alien life form themselves, you know, whereas we're flesh and blood. You know, they could be like an energy intelligence, an energy-based intelligence, rather than having like a 3D physical form. You know, there are various theories about these balls of light. You know, did they make the crop circles? Do they, you know, are they another unexplained phenomenon that's actually interested in the crop circles? You know, some people wonder if it's actually connected or if it's two phenomena that are separate. You know, it's difficult
there
to say.
There was that one famous crop circle picture with the two orbs. I think it's the only one they've ever been able to photograph. And you only see it briefly, but you see the orbs come out and dash back and forth, and seconds later, the crop circle is there.
There's a lot of footage of of orbs in relation to crop circles. I mean, it's just a matter of, you know, looking for them. But I mean, I've got various friends who have investigated the crop circle mystery for years, and they've all seen at some point or other these orbs. And you know, they've said we're not talking about somebody mistaking a satellite, you know, however many hundreds of miles up in the sky. We're talking about small balls of light hovering maybe 20 feet above the formation while they're actually inside the formation, you know. There's no way you can mistake it.
Absolutely. And I think the whole population has gotten tired of that business, the excuse that, well, it was a space balloon. I think we're over that one. I think they need to come up with a new story about that. Have you felt the energy from the crop circles yourself, or?
I think what I've found more than anything else is that, you know, I've definitely seen and watched the effect. This deep sort of spiritual effect that it has on a lot of people. You know, I used to go down to the crop circles a lot, and when I'm back in England now, you know, if I go over in the summer, I still try and make it where I can get down to, you know, see the formations. And the one thing you appreciate more than anything is that they have sort of like a transformative effect on people. Many of people, you know, have never really been in them before, but and they feel sort of changed, they feel energized, they feel, you know, enthusiastic for life, and that they've got sort of rejuvenated and energy, etc. And, you know, they come out of it almost like a new person, as if they've been sent on some sort of positive path, so to speak.
Yeah, it's an amazing. That's a good thing.
Yeah,
we could use more of, you know, spiritual transformation on this planet. A lot more. What about the ghost lights? You mentioned there's one chapter on ghost lights. What are those?
Well, ghost lights, basically, Lance, they've been seen around the world for years and years, centuries. And people might be familiar with one of the most famous ones, the so-called Marfa lights of Texas. And they're kind of similar, actually, to the balls of light that are seen over crop circles, but they're described as anywhere from the size of like a tennis ball up to like a beach ball, glowing balls of light that seem to have like almost like a hypnotic effect on people who see them. And very often, you know, the person sees one of these balls of light and then it suddenly transforms into something else, whether a UFO, a very human-looking alien, or some sort of almost like an angelic being occasionally. And, you know, I sort of speculate in the book that, again, maybe these balls of light, that's the literal physical appearance of these alien entities. But, you know, it's difficult for us to interact with something like that. So they manipulate certain parts of the human mind, such as like basically manipulate the human mind to where we perceive them as looking like something that we can relate to, you know, a human-looking alien. And they get this message across, which is generally sort of presented via like telepathy, ESP, that sort of thing. It's not like a spoken message. So in other words, you know, we see something we can relate to and the message comes into us in our heads. To me, that sounds like a plausible scenario of a phenomenon that can't literally physically talk to us and that looks like nothing on Earth. And so and so it tries to make the communication easier for us to cope with and understand. So I think, you know, that sometimes when these people report seeing long-haired aliens from this star system or whatever, it's an imagery. It's like a constructed, I won't say manipulation because that sort of sounds a bit sinister, but it is a manipulation of the mind, but for a reason to where it allows us to understand what it's doing.
I don't mind that. I certainly would think that would be a logical way to proceed because we are pretty barbaric.
Yes.
And, you know, my goodness, we've hardly stepped out of the primordial ooze. We're just still fighting wars, and we're still subject to greed and all the strange things that go on in the planet that seems like we should have outgrown a while ago. But, I mean, if I were an advanced being coming here, I think I'd turn my ship around and go the other way. Go home, quick. This is a danger zone. They've got atomic bombs and everything else, and they love to play. So,
well, again, that's
one
of the things I often warn both abductees and contactees about, you know, is these sort of, they present sort of imagery in the person's mind of the future, like the planet exploding or just collapsing through environmental collapse or nuclear war, etc. You know, that's sort of a familiar motif that's been present right back to the contactees and through the abductees today, that the idea that they're, you know, some people have suggested they're showing visions of the future of the Earth dying or whatever. I actually don't think that is what's happening. I think they're creating images in the mind of the people to make them think about what the future could be. Because,
yeah,
you know,
as a possible reality.
Yeah, it's because, you know, some people talk about seeing visions of nuclear disaster. Other people see images of ecological disaster, the polar ice caps, etc. And I think, you know, it's almost like an either-or situation rather than, so in other words, you know, it can't be nuclear war if it's going to be ecological collapse, etc. So I think they're creating imagery in the minds of the people they take or they contact, really to try and have certain people, you know, be aware of how we need to change our ways. And possibly this is being done on a very large scale to where now, you know, people are concerned and realize that there are big problems if we don't change our ways. And, you know, it's possible that the reason we're so conscious of it is because they've instilled it in us. You know, that is a possibility.
Yeah, that I definitely think so. And, of course, many science fiction movies and Spielberg's work in particular, he did a wonderful series on Contacts. I can't think of the name of it.
Taken.
Now, yes. Oh, my goodness, that was just brilliant. And then his movie, War of the Worlds. Was it War of the Worlds? No, War of the Worlds. It kind of surprised me because it was so violent. And I thought, why would somebody who knows so much make such a movie? And then I started thinking, well, what if there were Martians or aliens that came from another planet that were underneath us? And, you know, he happened to get wind of it, and he turned that into a movie that made us stop and think that maybe, you know, we're living on top of something and they're down there. You know, and I wouldn't be surprised if they're underground bases. You know, they're finding them all the time.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you know, even the military, our military has huge underground installations.
Oh, they're size of cities. They're building them like there's no tomorrow.
Yeah, well, that may be why they are building them.
Well, I have to admit, lots of people who are aware of 2012 and the whole, you know, my entire timeline and countdown and the rest of it say that that's what's happening, that they've had some kind of future technology that allows them to, the looking glass technology, that allows them to look into the future. And so they're busy, you know, trying to batten down the hatches and get out of Dodge. But in the meantime, you know, we normal people, we have to kind of try to piece all this together and make some kind of sense of it.
No, you're right. And I think that's one of the problems why, in many respects, we're still looking for the answers about the UFO mystery, because it interacts with us, but it does so it stays in the background.
Yeah.
You know, I think we would have answered the mystery years ago if they just landed, etc., etc.
Yeah.
But they're almost like a silent partner that sort of subtly pushes us in certain directions.
That's right.
But he's prepared to stay behind the scenes. And I think when that happens, we're forced to sort of connect the dots ourselves and try and make sense of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've made a pretty good headway, but, you know, we're probably still a long way from understanding the full agenda, unless they decide to land and spill the beans, so to speak.
Well, especially if there are numerous agendas by different groups. I mean, this mm-hmm. is quite possible. I've seen where certain military people have said, well, there are 52 to 57 types that are completely different and distinct, and they all have different, approaches. So, in fact, that might have been where Heinz 57 ketchup came from. I don't know. But, there could be, I've had guests who have talked to extra-dimensionals, extra-celestials, just about anything you can think of, and some are just so full of love and light and joy, and they're beautiful, and, you know, but are we really seeing that? Well, the people who experience it seem to feel it, so that's kind of a good place to start. What does it feel like? You know, does it feel like a loving energy?
Yeah.
So there could be a lot of different agendas, and most of them unknown because they're staying back and we're being looked at under the microscope.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think, you know, we all have to compare that with people on Earth. I mean, people are complex animals.
Oh, yeah.
That would be the same, I think, for any advanced species. You know, the idea that when people say, are the aliens good or bad? Well, it's like human beings. Human beings aren't good or bad. You know, it's not as black and white as that. There's situations that people are placed into and people make wrong decisions. You know, it's kind of like somebody is a really... trustworthy, honest person, responsible, and then one night they have a couple too many beers, they jump in the car and kill someone. you know what I mean? They just hit them in the car. And it's kind of like, that's a terrible thing.
Yes, it is.
But they try to live their life well. It's kind of, in other words, it's like black, you know, outer space, I don't think is any more black and white as people are on Earth in terms of, you know, how you try and understand somebody's mindset and character. So I think that I wouldn't be surprised if we get the truth one day, it demonstrates that their reason for coming here primarily is self-serving in the same way anything we do is for our benefit primarily. I think if they'd wanted to destroy us, they could have easily done it before we had rockets, atomic weapons, etc.
Yes, I think that's a good point.
Yeah, so I don't think destruction of us is on the cards, or at least not, you know, right now. but on the other hand, you know, they don't seem to want to land and, you know, save the rainforests, or, you know, save the polar ice caps, but they seem to want us to understand there are problems that need resolving. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, I sort of speculated to people in the past, maybe it's kind of like the parents and the kids, you know, you don't want your kids to be over-reliant on you to where, you know, they never grow up and experience life.
But you do need
to sort of tell them of some of the hazards, you know. If somebody, a stranger comes up to you, you don't talk to them, that sort of thing. And I think it could be like that. They're trying to push us, but not have us become over-reliant to where our society becomes just totally absorbed by theirs. You know, we just hand the reins over to them and say, look after us. I don't think they want that.
No, I agree with you. I totally agree with you. And there have been numerous instances, as you know, probably many more than I do, but one I heard about just a couple of days ago, that one of the people who was in Stephen Greer's original Disclosure film spoke to a friend of mine, and he said that the silos where they had their missiles, you know, the strike missiles, were other people were seeing the ships. He did not see them, but he was one of the people that was operating the bases.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that systematically each silo with one of those, nuclear warheads or whatever they had on there was shut down one after another. And there was no explanation for it. There was no electrical problem. They were just being shut down by something, and the other people who were able to see what was going on the outside stated that there were UFOs overhead that were hovering around and circling and so on and so forth. So that wouldn't surprise me if we've been saved from ourselves a few times by our big brothers out there. But nobody wants the big brother. And it seems like big brother is coming heavily down in England with all the cameras and everything. It's a little concerning about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the things where it's sort of like a trend that's going everywhere nowadays. You know, it's like it's the governments are saying, well, we need to keep track on you. Why? War on terror. You know, it's almost like, yes, there are terrorists out there, but on the other hand, it's sadly, it's like certain governments are trying to capitalize on a threat. And
I think that's manufactured to
manufactured to take away our rights even more, basically. You know, the next thing will be why we all need to be implanted with a tracking device or something.
Absolutely.
You know, if it comes to that, I think people will, they'll just say enough's enough. If people line up outside, you know, their favorite store to, instead of getting your flu shot, you know, you get your implant. If they line up and have it like sheep, my view is that, well, you get what you deserve. But people should stand up and say, no, this is bull, you know.
Absolutely.
You know,
because we're just a step away from being a slave race.
Yeah, I mean, it could happen so easily where...
Today.
I mean, you know, they're talking about, for example, you know, microchipping your pets and getting people used to it and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And
your babies.
Your babies, yeah, and it'd be good because of A, B, C, whatever. And before you know it, you know, the next generation thinks it's normal.
Right. That's how it works.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's not like you have a coup or a revolution where overnight everything's changed. It's kind of subtly slipped in.
Yeah, with frogs boiling in a pot that's being turned up hotter and hotter.
Exactly. So I think there's a lot going down that, you know, is not good at all. And, you know, there are people, I think, in government who want our rights gone. You know, they want us just... totally under the thumb, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people have been talking about the chemtrail phenomenon recently. And, you know, I've been made aware of that for some time, but it was just the last few years that I've been seeing it going on so heavily in my own area. And we can't get any answers about that either.
No, there's lots of stuff like that, you know. I mean, people talk about these different viruses that keep surfacing, you know. Is there some sort of manufacture thing going on, you know? It's just a weird, it's become a very weird world in the last sort of 15 years or so.
Now, what about the, I should ask you, since you've investigated various things in Scotland and vampires and werewolves, what about the cattle mutilations? Has there been any resolution on those?
Not really. I mean, they still go on. Certainly, they were definitely at their height in sort of the mid to late 70s. There's no doubt about that. But reports have sort of been steadily reported since then. Now, cattle mutilations are interesting because you have a variety of different theories, all of which seem quite plausible, and all of which actually may be somehow interlinked. You know, you have the idea that it's aliens doing it, again, for genetic purposes or something like that.
Right.
There's also the theory that it's for the testing of, the military's doing it, for testing of things like germ warfare. And there are also stories, quite disturbing stories, that there's another arm of the government looking into it because they're worried that within the cattle herd, the U.S. cattle herd, that there are emerging viruses which can actually enter into the food chain. Things like mad cow disease, but, you know, in the human version, but that could be far more lethal. And, you know, so they're worried that, I mean, for example... a lot of research has been done suggesting that the huge increase, and it is a huge increase in the last few years of Alzheimer's in the U.S., which is now escalating. A lot of people, highly qualified people, think that a lot of cases of Alzheimer's in the U.S., this sudden rise, are actually misdiagnosed cases of something similar to the human form of mad cow disease, which has entered the food chain, and the large amounts of red meat that Americans eat is actually now manifesting with Alzheimer's-type conditions, which is actually...
Yeah.
I won't say Alzheimer's is hard to diagnose. I know it's not because my mom has Alzheimer's, but what I do know is that there are other conditions that closely mirror Alzheimer's. And, you know, this huge increase, you know, has actually coincides with, you know, the food industry, you know, more and more red meat being eaten. So, you know, in other words, there could be a link here with some people in the government doing the cattle mutes at the same time. That there could be genuinely unexplained ones as well. So everybody and his brother's doing them.
Well, you know, you would think that if they were doing that they would probably want to eliminate the bodies so that they didn't draw attention to them.
Mm.
But by dumping them like that and showing the the precision of these incisions and organs being removed almost through a tube, it kind of lends one to think that we're supposed to believe that this is some kind of a hostile group.
Yeah, I think the thing more than anything else, you know, with the crop circles is that, with cattle mutilations, is it seems that they want the cows to be found. You're quite right.
Yeah, right.
They want them to be found
people. I mean, they just fall out of the sky.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's no footprints around them, so it's a strange phenomenon.
Very strange.
I mean, Terrence McKenna said that, you know, as we approach 2012, time wave zero, things were going to get more and more novel, and novel isn't always good.
No, that's right.
You know, it's going to be more bizarre and more strange, and we're just going to have to buckle our seatbelts and be prepared. Now, on all your travels, you've done so many things. You've been to various countries investigating other things besides this. What's the most interesting thing you've found that... or that you've researched in other countries?
I would definitely, in other countries, I would definitely say the various expeditions I've been on to Puerto Rico looking for the chupacabra. This sort of weird vampire-type creature that's, you know, described as having like a monkey-like body, an alien-type face, and fangs, claws, and, you know, sort of very lethal, sort of blood-sucking predator is how a lot of the people described it. And, you know, I've been there quite a lot and, you know, spent extensive time on Puerto Rico and, you know, spoken with farmers, police officers, veterinarians, all who've been able to give their perspective and take the subject very, very seriously that, you know, there really are creatures, whatever they are, running around Puerto Rico and just slaughtering farm animals and draining them of blood. So, very weird phenomenon.
So it is a real, I mean, there's something's really happening.
Oh, yeah, I mean,
there.
The authorities on Puerto Rico take it very, very seriously, yeah.
Nobody's been able to get them on video or...
Well, there's a few photographs, but they're kind of controversial. But the problem is that most of the attacks occur late at night or in the early hours.
Yeah.
So it's not till daylight that the bodies of the farm animals are found. So in other words, these creatures seem to be pretty much nocturnal. They also seem to be very intelligent and cunning, almost. And, of course, you know, most Puerto Rico, unfortunately, is a sort of very poor... environment, and so most people, you know, they just don't have the resources to buy expensive cameras and set up equipment, etc.
Right.
Try and catch them. They're just trying to, you know, put food on the table for next week or whatever. So,
you
know, that sort of makes it difficult that they just don't have the people themselves. You know, they just don't have the resources and time to, or even the inclination, I suppose, to solve it. They just want it to stop. So,
right. Now, what about the vampires?
Well, yeah, I've done a lot of research into that. Now, you know, I don't go along with the classic Hollywood idea of somebody gets bitten on the neck and they turn into a vampire and, you know, they run around in black cloaks and things like that. But I do think, I mean, there's no doubt that throughout the world and history and legend and folklore, there are stories of predatory, blood-sucking creatures. Sometimes literal blood-sucking vampires, sometimes described as like an emotional vampire where people are just sort of, you know, wiped out of energy and falling sick all the time as if they're feeding on the human energy or the life force.
They're definitely psychic vampires.
Yeah, psychic vampires, yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And I think,
no question about it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these legends and stories stem from there's some sort of negative paranormal phenomenon that feeds whether psychically or physically on us, and it's led to a lot of these legends of today's vampires, you know, sort of the Bela Lugosi type thing in the 30s or, you know, some sort of hot babe running around in sort of black and, you know, biting people on the neck or whatever today, which is far more entertaining. But
it absolutely is. It's much more melodramatic.
Yeah, exactly. But whether it's But I think, you know, joking aside, I think a lot of these legends, of these today's tales, have the like a foothold in some very real events in the past where, you know, there were vampire-type beings amongst us.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you totally. And, well, even if you go back to the idea of the pictures of Satan and the horns and the scales, well, that it's conceivable that they could have been seeing reptilian forms that were showing themselves.
Yeah.
I know David Icke seems to believe that that's the case, that they're able to shapeshift and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of mysteries that are unexplained, fortunately. We don't have the answer, so there's lots of room for investigation out there, folks,
That's right.
You want to go out and start digging. Before we come to the end, a couple of things. What would you like to leave the listeners with as far as something from your book or your experience that would be interesting?
Well, you know, I mean, people always say to me, you know, what do you think's going on and how do we get the answers? I always say to people, you know, several things. One is, you know, based on my investigations, you know, the whole range of weird phenomena that, you know, the media and the skeptics dismiss are real. You know, whether it's weird creatures like Bigfoot, UFOs, psychic phenomena, when you cut through the hoaxes and the misidentifications, there are real phenomena. And I would also always say to people, if you've got an interest and you want to do research, don't be put off by people who, you know, complain or say it's all nonsense. You know, just put, you know, believe in yourself and go out there and do the investigations. And always listen to witness testimony, because it doesn't matter who writes a book or who makes a movie or whatever. The most important people are the witnesses, because without the witnesses, we don't have anything.
So, you know,
we always need to be... to appreciate the people who've seen these things and willing to talk about their experiences and encourage them to come forward if they can.
Yes, absolutely. You've been absolutely wonderful, and I know that people want to know how to reach you and how to buy your book, contactees. What's your website?
Website's nickredfern.com, which is NickRedFern, and I do a lot of blogging. I've got various blogs on a whole range of subjects, and they're all linked at the website where I do all the latest news and reviews of the different blogs and things like that.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
And people can contact me at the website as well.
Wonderful. I loved your book, like I said.
Oh,
and
thanks.
It's filled in so many blanks, and it's well written, and it's just a fascinating story. And like I said, I was not clued in with all the early ones, but I do remember my parents talking about Adamski and other people, and this really just... created a foundation for me now to look upon, you know, to see where this came from. And it's definitely evolving. And we don't know where it's evolving to, but it looks like we're in for something of an interesting ride here on planet Earth.
Oh, yeah, there's been a lot on the horizon, 2012, things like that. So.
Absolutely. Well, the next show is James Gilliland. He has his East City Ranch out there, and he does a show as you wish. Talk radio, and he often has guests who are out there on the ranch looking at the at the ships powering up and so on. So if people are interested in this kind of stuff, be sure and stay tuned to Jim's show. And he's always got interesting guests and lots of things going on up there at the ranch. So, Nick, I thank you so much for being on the show. And you're just terrific. I'd love to have you back again.
No, anytime you want me on, you know, if any breaking stories or you just want to general paranormal chats, I mean, I'm quite happy to. Just let me know.
Okay. I will do that.
All right.
Thanks a million, Nick.
All right.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. And that's a wrap. Good night,
Thanks,
everybody.
Guys.
Good night, Nick.
Thanks. Good night.